Welcome to the Geographical Podcast Editor's Picks. My name's Katie Burton, I'm Geographical's Associate Editor. In this podcast, we pick out three pieces from our print magazine or our website, geographical.co.uk, and read them out loud. This week, we begin with an opinion piece by Andrew Brooks, a reader in uneven development and deputy head of the Geography Department at King's College London. His new book, Bullshit Comparisons, A Field Guide to Thinking Critically in a World of Difference, is out now. In his article for Geographical, Brooks documented his experience of hospitals in Sierra Leone and argues that making use of historical comparisons when it comes to African hospitals, such as comparing them to British hospitals 100 years ago, is entirely misguided and unhelpful. Next, a rare bit of good news. A new study reveals that worldwide nature conservation is working. The study provides the strongest evidence to date that conservation interventions are an effective tool against biodiversity loss and that we should keep going, ramping up efforts to protect nature. And finally, our cover story from the April issue of Geographical magazine, in which our writer Bryony Cottam speaks to botanist and explorer Chris Thorogood about his hunt for the world's largest and smelliest flower, Rafflesia.
Hospitals are worse in Africa than in any other region in the world. In Sierra Leone, they are worse than in most of Africa. The infant mortality rate of 78 deaths per 1,000 births is shocking and among the highest anywhere. In stark comparison, it's 4 in the UK. For further context, life expectancy is 82 in the UK versus just 60 years in Sierra Leone. The sharp differences in healthcare outcomes are mainly a function of huge disparities in annual income, which is $46,624 in Britain against $1,613 per capita in the West African nation. There is evidently a chasm in the basic conditions of life. So, is it not helpful to think about the two places as being at different historical steps on the same development ladder? Taking life expectancy as a historical comparison, Britons could expect to live to the age of 60 way back in 1935. So maybe we can think of Sierra Leone as being nearly a century behind the UK? Intuitively, it seems to make sense. However, there are serious problems with this type of historical comparison, especially as there is a connection between good healthcare in the UK and weak healthcare provisions in Sierra Leone. I interviewed international doctors and nurses working in Sierra Leone. They made unfavourable comparisons between their experiences of Western hospitals and the local facilities. One described Connaught Hospital, the principal referral hospital in the capital Freetown, as a hellhole. People were dying all the time of stuff they shouldn't die of, as another doctor told me. A tragic example, among many, was of an anemic 13-year-old girl who died because she didn't receive a blood transfusion. One physician observed it was a little bit like going back in time. A published surgical report showed that hospitals in Sierra Leone were worse in 2010 than the facilities of the Union Army during the US Civil War, more than 150 years earlier. The assessments about the level of care are disturbing and undoubtedly accurate, but what is not so helpful is when these comparisons are framed historically. Moving around the hospital, talking with local and international staff, I saw the suffering of patients and the tough working conditions, but I wasn't stepping into the past, but rather walking through a painful present. Wards with poor hygiene and lack of drugs were part of a globalised world of smartphones and the internet. Patients were as keen to talk to me about last night's Manchester United game as their medical care. Most of the foreign doctors and nurses I talked with were experts in medicine, not human geography. Prior to travelling to Sierra Leone, they drew from a well of general knowledge that tries to explain the differences between rich and poor nations as being the result of local factors such as warfare, corruption, or disasters, rather than understanding how impoverishment is related to colonialism and is sustained by unequal world trade. The clearest way to pull apart the historical comparison is to think about the employment of Sierra Leonean doctors and nurses at home and internationally. Connaught Hospital was vastly understaffed, but the quality of local healthcare workers wasn't the problem. As a Western doctor explained, the Sierra Leonean clinicians' anatomy knowledge and technical skills were fantastic. It's just all the other supporting elements that need work. As another described, one of the surgical doctors is trained to an incredibly high standard. He knows what's good. So African doctors weren't stuck in the past practicing the medicine of 100 years ago. The same went for the nurses, who were in demand overseas. An estimated 60% of Sierra Leonean trained nurses emigrate. They seek a better life in the UK, Canada, the USA, and nearby, but more affluent, Ghana. There are 520 Sierra Leonean health workers in the NHS, and many more employed in other support jobs and private care homes, as well as thousands across other developed countries. The number in the NHS may seem small, but it's equivalent to 16% of Sierra Leone's entire public health workforce. Sierra Leone desperately needs more health workers to improve patient care, but the majority of those who are trained locally want to emigrate and make a better life for themselves. The nurses I talked with always asked about opportunities to come to London. This is logical. You can't blame anyone for wanting to emigrate. Work at Connaught Hospital is hard and salaries too low to support even a basic standard of living. Nurses survive by selling medicines to patients, and doctors subsidise their meagre government salaries by working in private clinics. The pull to emigrate is a problem of 21st century globalisation, not something that Western nations had to face when they progressed up a development ladder. Doctors and nurses in 1930s Britain enjoyed relatively good salaries and weren't compelled to seek new opportunities overseas. We can't think of the Connaught as being a museum-like hospital of the past. It exists now in today's interconnected world. As well as disadvantaging countries such as Sierra Leone, the immigration of doctors and nurses improves healthcare in Britain and other affluent countries. There are 5,819 African nationals working as doctors in the NHS. In total, around 27% of doctors in the UK were trained in developing countries. If fewer doctors and nurses left the world's poorest countries for the richest, what's sometimes called the medical brain drain, then there wouldn't be such a gap in healthcare. And yet there's a very real need for more healthcare workers in Britain's NHS, a problem shared by nearly every country in the world. That said, the scale of the shortfall in Africa is truly staggering. There are 280 physicians per 100,000 people in the UK. On average, across sub-Saharan Africa, there are 20 per 100,000, but in Sierra Leone, just 2 per 100,000. How do development programmes such as the one at Connaught Hospital that brought Western healthcare workers to work in impoverished settings fit into this picture? Can aid work help push nations up the development ladder? Some inspiring people do amazing, life-saving work every day in difficult circumstances, but the overall scale of international development assistance in the healthcare sector is tiny. It's a cliché, but they are a sticking plaster on a gaping wound. There are systemic problems that global development programs can't answer. Worldwide, there are far too few health workers, and they are in demand across a globalised job marketplace. Like any employment market, those with much-needed skills tend to move to where wages are highest. Few people head in the other direction for an overseas adventure. African healthcare workers migrate to work in British hospitals, in numbers that dwarf the counter-movement of UK medical aid and volunteers. National comparisons hide the globalisation of the health sector. The high standards of hospitals in rich countries and the long life expectancies aren't just a result of the histories and conditions internal to these societies, but rather depend on global flows of migration and draw upon resources, medicines, and scientific discoveries produced around the world. Equally, rather than being stuck in the past, Sierra Leone's poor healthcare is a prisoner of the present, trapped not only by the outflows of skilled people but by wider structural challenges. Even if all the Sierra Leonean health workers trained locally were retained, there would still be a huge shortfall in the ratio of doctors to patients and multiple other elements of the national healthcare system that needed desperate attention, all of which would require money that Sierra Leone doesn't have. Ultimately, poverty resulting from uneven international trading relationships and an absence of industrial development block improvements in medical provision. Often, historical comparisons project visions of how people want the world to be rather than how it is. In international development, comparisons frequently support ideas that blame global inequalities on domestic conditions within poor countries, weak government, civil unrest, or an underutilized natural environment. By casting the challenge of global development as an individual teleological problem of maturity, developing countries are still in an adolescent stage of growth in comparison to the established, fully developed adult economies of Europe and North America, is a profoundly misleading and patronizing comparison. there is no inevitable pathway that will lead Africa to catch up with the West that depends on anything more than the march of time. Rather, we need to transform economic and political structures instead of passively waiting for the decades to tick by. A historical comparison dissolves the responsibility of the global North for inequality. To lift the poorest out of impoverishment, we need to continue to make comparisons, for example, in healthcare indicators, such as life expectancy and infant mortality, but also to think about the wider relationships, those real-world political connections between rich and poor countries such as debts, migration, uneven patterns of trade, environmental degradation that have produced and sustain an unequal world.
Next, some good news from the world of conservation.
New evidence reveals that, worldwide, nature conservation is working. Not only that, scientists say that if we can scale up conservation efforts, it would be transformational for halting and reversing biodiversity loss. The findings come from a first-of-its-kind study published in the journal Science, which provides the strongest evidence to date that conservation interventions are an effective tool against biodiversity loss. Our study shows that when conservation actions work, they really work, says author and conservation scientist Jake Bicknell, a professor at the University of Kent. In other words, they often lead to outcomes for biodiversity that are not just a little bit better than doing nothing at all, but many times greater. In a comprehensive meta-analysis of conservation actions taken over the last century, including the establishment and management of protected areas, the eradication and control of invasive species, and the sustainable management and restoration of habitats and ecosystems, a team of scientists found that in most cases, 66%, biodiversity improved or slowed its decline. Examples of some of the conservation success stories studied include Redonda, once a barren Caribbean island plagued with rats, where habitat restoration and the removal of invasive species has transformed the landscape into a thriving biodiversity hotspot. Tropical forests in the Congo Basin, where forest management plans and FSC certification have reduced deforestation, in some cases by as much as 74%, and support higher populations of large and endangered animals. The revival of the Saiga antelope, whose numbers have increased from 21,000 to 1.3 million individuals. And Zapata Swamp, where a breeding facility for critically endangered Cuban crocodiles has successfully released crocodile hatchlings into the wild. Even in cases where conservation actions did not succeed in recovering or slowing the decline of species or ecosystems, conservation has benefited from the lessons learned. In fact, the authors of the study found a correlation between more recent conservation interventions and positive outcomes for biodiversity, suggesting that conservation is getting more effective over time. With more than 44,000 species currently documented as being at risk of extinction, Oxford University ecologist and study co-author Joseph Bull says the results clearly show that there is room for hope. Biodiversity loss is a crisis that is projected to have tremendous consequences for the Earth's ecosystems, as well as the billions of people around the world who depend on them. It's estimated that more than half of the world's GDP, almost $44 trillion US dollars, is moderately or highly dependent on nature. This study comes at a critical time where the world has agreed on ambitious and needed global biodiversity targets that will require conservation action at an entirely new scale, says Claude Gascon, a director at the Global Environment Facility, which provides grants for biodiversity projects. Achieving this is not only possible, it is well within our grasp as long as it is appropriately prioritised.
And finally, our cover story from the April issue of Geographical magazine, in which our writer Bryony Cottam follows the adventures of Chris Thorogood and his hunt for the world's largest flower.
Deep in the humid tropical forests of central Sumatra, Chris Thorogood is hunting for a tiger. Its striking appearance should make it easy to spot. A fully mature specimen is reddish-orange, with a unique pattern of white blotches covering its skin. The largest can get surprisingly big, and it has a pungent scent that's said to smell like rotting meat. Across the island, networks of experts and enthusiasts patrol the forests, scouring the vegetation for signs, including the presence of its prey, yet despite all this, it's very rarely found. Thorogood admits that his own chances of finding one are remote. Many of his previous expeditions have ended in failure. That hasn't deterred him from trying. "You'll understand when I show you a photo," he says, turning his phone to face the webcam that's recording our video call. It's the most extraordinary work of nature. On the screen, I see what appears to be a large five-petaled flower. Its red and white markings bear a resemblance to those on a tiger's face, earning it the Indonesian name Cendawan Mukarimau, the tiger-faced mushroom. However, this is no fungus. Rafflesia herceltii is a parasitic plant. Even as a child, Thorogood was fascinated by the more unusual and what some might call the uglier side of nature. No disrespect to those who work on them, but dolphins, killer whales, the animals of the Serengeti. "That's just not my bag," he says with a laugh. The windowsill of his childhood bedroom was cluttered with fish tanks that he filled with rainforest plants. Climbing vines festooned the curtain pole, and a dog-eared book full of photos of strange, exotic plants took pride of place on his bedside table. He was obsessed with starfish too, as well as sea cucumbers, sea potatoes, and all manner of squishy and shapeless marine invertebrates. But it was the plant world that truly piqued his curiosity, and, of all the photographs in that book, one grotesque-looking, lumpy, great starfish of a flower in particular. 8-year-old Thorogood knew that he had to see it with his own eyes. Today he sees a lot of strange-looking plants. His Instagram account is an endless stream of his own colourful illustrations and photographs of the species he encounters through his work as a botanist at the University of Oxford's Botanic Garden, as well as the plants he still grows on his windowsill, or that he has trekked through thick jungles to find. He hopes the remarkable bloom of R. hasseltii will be next on his list. "That isn't even one of the largest ones," he says, as I stare at his phone screen. Measuring roughly half a metre across, the flower he's showing me is, in fact, one of the smaller of the 42 known species of Rafflesia that can be found in forests throughout Southeast Asia. Its cousin, R. arnoldii, can grow to more than a metre wide, making it the largest flower in the world. 2 weeks before his departure for Indonesia, I call Thorogood to ask about his upcoming trip and to hear him talk about these huge mysterious flowers. He's spent much of his working life trying to better understand and protect them, a journey he has documented in his newly published book Pathless Forest. "Who are you talking to today?" I hear my boyfriend ask as I open up my laptop to log into Zoom. "I'm talking to a botanist about plants," I tell him. Boring. He's being facetious, but it's a stigma the field of botany is struggling to shake. Botanists are disappearing from our scientific institutions. Fewer students are studying botany and fewer universities are offering it as a degree, sometimes resulting in the closure of costly but important plant collections. In February, to the chagrin of plant scientists everywhere, Duke University in the USA closed the doors to its 100-year-old herbarium, a collection comprising more than 825,000 specimens of terrestrial plants, fungi and algae, one of the largest in the country. Sebastian Stroud, a botanist at the University of Leeds, suggests that the diminishing interest in botanical sciences could be explained by something called plant blindness. The term, which was coined by American botanists Elizabeth Schussler and James Wandersee, refers to a person's inability to see the plants in the environment around them. It's a phenomenon that Thorogood knows all too well. "I notice that lots of people think of plants as inanimate," he says. "Sometimes I'll show someone a Venus flytrap and they'll say to me, 'Oh, look, it's alive because it's moving.' And that says to me, 'Gosh, people don't even think of plants as living.'" His own fascination with plants, he suggests, could be explained by the fact that he has always noticed them. "And I think having a scientific and inquisitive turn of mind meant I wanted to know more about them," he says. "I wanted to know how they grew in a certain way and why. And so I experimented. I suppose I didn't think of them as experiments as a child, but they were rudimentary experiments." These experiments have continued at the Botanic Gardens where he works today. "There aren't many of us that grow parasitic plants," he says with a smile. "We've grown things that have never been grown before, which is really exciting." Thorogood estimates that as many as 3/4 of all parasitic plant species have never been cultivated. Many don't exist in seed banks either. They're a bit of a blind spot for curators and botanists seeking to conserve the world's flora he says, and that's really concerning. Although he and his colleagues have managed to establish a collection of parasitic plants at the University of Oxford, Thorogood says that only one botanist has ever successfully managed to propagate a species of Rafflesia. Parasitic plants take many forms. Viscum album, more commonly known as mistletoe, is perhaps the most widely known example in Europe. It grows in clusters on apple, hawthorn, and other host trees, from which it leaches the water and nutrients it needs to survive, supplementing the energy its own leaves produce from photosynthesis. Cuscuta, a thread-like vine with folk names such as strangleweed and devil's hair, has no roots or leaves at all. An obligate parasite, it's completely dependent on the nutrients it steals from its host, tree or shrub, often killing it in the process. Rafflesia are also obligate parasites that feed on forest vines, but these peculiar plants have evolved to spend almost their entire life cycle inside their host. Once a Rafflesia seed has infected a vine, how exactly this happens remains a mystery. It sends out fine filaments of cells, called sinkers, that penetrate the vine's connective tissues and extract the nutrients it needs. The Rafflesia will remain undetected in this endophytic form, sometimes for years, until suddenly it erupts from the vine as a golf ball-sized bud. It takes up to 9 months for a Rafflesia bud to develop. It will eventually swell to the size of a cabbage, allowing local experts a rough estimate of when it will finally flower. They call this bloom prediction, says Thorogood. He's lucky, he says, to have friends and colleagues on the ground who know where to look while that small window of time is open. A few years ago, Thorogood and some of his colleagues from the Philippines travelled to Bogor Botanic Garden in Indonesia to meet Nyatari, the senior horticulturist and the only person to have successfully propagated Rafflesia, for a private propagation workshop. Thorogood watched Nyatari demonstrate how to cut a section of an infected vine carefully to avoid damaging the mother plant and graft it to a new, uninfected vine. Honestly, I've never paid so much attention in my life, he says. Equipped with this new knowledge, Thorogood and his colleagues return to the Philippines in search of a suitable test subject, R. panchoana, which has flowers the size of my outstretched hand. It has a healthier population than other species, such as R. balatae, which has only been found in a tiny parcel of rainforest in the middle of a banana plantation, he says. They took a section of vine infected with R. panchoana and grafted it to another in a remote protected area of forest. You have to cut the vine in a very certain way, then meld the tissues, bind it, and hope that the recipient vine accepts it. Then you wait. Hopefully, the Rafflesia will jump from one host to another. At least, that's what Mr. Ngateri has got it to do. Globally, parasitic plants play an important role in shaping and sustaining ecosystem biodiversity. Many face an uncertain future, yet they are often overlooked in extinction research. In September 2023, Thorogood co-published a paper highlighting the inadequate inclusion of Rafflesia on the IUCN Red List. Currently, a single species, R. magnifica, is classified as critically endangered, and yet most are threatened with extinction, he says. With their survival contingent on a single host vine species, Rafflesia are particularly vulnerable to change. Most of their forest habitats are increasingly fragmented by logging or slash-and-burn agriculture. What's more, Thorogood explains that the chance of both a male and a female flower emerging at the same time and being visited by the same fly, as is required for pollination, are slim. They're very particular plants in every respect. For many years, Thorogood felt that he wasn't doing enough to secure a future for Rafflesia. He'd published papers calling for their conservation, but taken no direct action himself. It was an uncomfortable thought. At the propagation workshop, however, something changed. I remember that on the flight home I felt quite calm. It's not, he says, a feeling with which he's very familiar. There was this sense of serenity. I felt that we'd really achieved something together as a team, and I'm truly proud of that. It will be another year, maybe two, before he knows whether the Rafflesia has jumped from the grafted vine to its new host, before the telltale signs of a new flower bud might start to appear on the host vine. But what I can tell you is that my colleagues were in touch with me just a couple of days ago, says Thorogood, on his way to meet them on the forested slopes of Mount McKeeling. They went to check on it, and we now know that the graft itself was successful, so there's every reason to believe that it will work.
Thank you for listening to the Geographical Podcast Editor's Picks. If you enjoyed it, please do subscribe. And don't forget, you can read all of these stories and many more on our website. Or why not consider taking out a subscription to our print magazine, Geographical, released monthly and full of stunning photography and stories from all around the globe.